bipartisan calls to investigate the Biden administration's chaotic exit from Afghanistan are growing. At least four committees in Congress have been announced and plan to investigate or hold hearings into what went wrong, each of them led by Democrats, Biden's own party. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about that and more. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of how the Biden administration handled the exit from Afghanistan? Do you want to see Congress investigate what went wrong? Do you think someone from the administration should be held accountable for what we've seen over the last week? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Reed Wilson is with us now. He is a national correspondent at The Hill. Reed, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so let's start with a clip of Democratic Representative Seth Moulton. He's a former Marine and represents Massachusetts in Congress. Here's what he had to say about Afghanistan yesterday on MSNBC.
The best thing that Joe Biden can do right now for his politics is rectify the operation in Afghanistan, save as many lives as we can, get out of there with our heads held much higher than they are today. End this chaos, get a good plan, admit responsibility, as he started to do yesterday in his speech, for the things that went wrong, but most of all, fix it.
And Representative Moulton is referring to President Biden's address on Tuesday there. Now, Reed, what kind of blowback is the Biden administration getting from Congress on the withdrawal?
Well, from Congress, it's almost universally negative. The Biden administration has not found a lot of allies, even among Democrats, for the results of the pullout. Now, broadly, there is bipartisan consensus that the United States needed to leave Afghanistan, but the way it happened and the rapid deterioration that we've seen over the last week, I think, caught everybody by surprise. And with those four hearings that you mentioned are going to get contentious and nasty. It struck me just how few members of Congress were willing to come to the defense of a president, even though his own party is in the majority. And even though, you know, again, as I say, both sides were in favor of getting our troops out of Afghanistan. Remember, this is a process that started under President Trump.
Now, you said that there was almost close to universal consensus within Congress that how this went down was not good. And as you said, it's rare that you don't hear at least a few members of Congress, especially from the president's own party, come to their defense. How significant is that?
Well, I'm not sure right now, because my answer was going to be different to your first question if you hadn't added the words "in Congress." I'm not certain how much the American public is going to pay attention to this in the long run. Some of the really excellent analyses that I've read over the last couple of weeks have pointed to the fact that after the American withdrawal from Vietnam, you know, President Ford didn't face a lot of blowback in the following election there. As a matter of fact, his approval rating went up. Americans were basically done with the war in Afghanistan. This is, you know, it's been going on for 20 years. There was almost no support for staying in the long run, even if that's what was required to maintain stability in the country. And, you know, we've spent billions of dollars. The last three presidents have all promised to get out of Afghanistan. Two of them didn't do so. The third one now has. We'll see if voters reward that or criticize that or even remember in a year. I mean, I feel like the average American had virtually no interest in Afghanistan up until just the last couple of weeks. It sort of became America's forgotten war, even as it was America's longest war.
Now, sticking with that, I mean, the politics were a little bit different between the Vietnam War, which was deeply unpopular, and as you mentioned, the Afghanistan War, which was largely forgotten. You know, do you think that we could see, I mean, historically, I mean, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but how do you think we'll look back at this?
well, how will we look back at the war? We'll look back at the war as a massive failure of American foreign policy, a failure that has extended over four presidents, one in which America was routinely distracted, even as American service members were dying. We lost more than 2,400 service members. Thousands more were injured in Afghanistan. Thousands more contractors, you know, American citizens who were working for the U.S. government in various capacities, lost their lives in Afghanistan. This will go down as a failure on par with the Vietnam War, even if the death count was only a fraction of what happened in Vietnam. But you know, the question is, was this thing winnable in the first place? And there are oral histories taken by the Defense Department that suggest that the U.S. military knew that it wasn't. That this is Afghanistan is the graveyard where empires go to die, or at least go to fail in big military missions, whether it's Russia, whether it's the British, and now us.
We are talking to Reed Wilson right now, national correspondent at The Hill, and we are talking about the political response to what we've seen unfold in Afghanistan after the Biden administration withdrew troops from that country. And let's go now to kind of those political ramifications. What do you expect to see, you know, as, you know, the weeks kind of play out, maybe from Republicans here? We've heard that the Democrats aren't happy. What are we hearing from Republicans?
Well, we're hearing from Republicans a sort of revisionist history here. They are arguing that this was a winnable war, that the Biden administration has screwed up what was a path to victory. And I don't think that was the case. I mean, the Trump administration is the administration that started this dialogue with the Taliban, that began agreeing to release Taliban prisoners, including some of the new senior officials in the Taliban government. And Republicans who have been most vocal about this are, I think, the Republicans who opposed sort of the concept of what the Trump administration was doing as well. We're going to see sort of a new birth of the hawkish Republican right, if you will, a group that Donald Trump did not belong to by any stretch. You've started to see people like Liz Cheney and Congressman Adam Kinzinger from Illinois talk about the failure of the Trump-Biden approach to Afghanistan. I mean, that phrase alone has really stuck out to me. This is sort of the moment that the neocons get to revitalize themselves, if they can.
Can you talk about the genesis of that phrase, the Trump-Biden approach?
Yeah, I mean, this, again, is a process that began during the Trump administration. President Trump promised to pull the U.S. out of Afghanistan and began sending the signals that the U.S. would leave. That apparently began a series of deals that the Taliban began to strike with local Afghan military units, effectively getting them to lay down their weapons in exchange for, what's the phrase? An amnesty, forgiveness, if you will, if they would give their weapons to the Taliban. This has been a long-term process, right? The Taliban didn't wake up overnight and decide that they were going to retake the country. This has been going on for several years now, even as multiple administrations now have pursued a political outcome, a political solution in negotiations in Doha, Qatar. And the fact is now for lack of a better term, neocon supporters of a war in Afghanistan and opponents of the pullout, whether it happened under Trump or Biden, have now seen their moment to draw a contrast with both. And for somebody like a Liz Cheney, who is already on the never Trump, anti-Trump side, that's a good way to sort of reassert a brand of Republicanism that basically hasn't held office since the Bush administration.
Now, Reed, I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Mark in Grosse Pointe. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
And what did you want to say, Mark?
Thanks so much for taking my call. I 100% agree with your guest. And to lay on top of the Biden-Trump disaster is an excellent way for the GOP to begin walking away from Trump. And, you know, the Josh Hawleys, the Ted Cruzes, the DeSantis can really use that narrative. And I can see that in the midterms, and actually see it, in 4 years, is that, ads was the narrative going across the ads of the Trump Biden disaster. You take a look at the southern border, and then they lay into, pictures of thousands of people running on the tarmac, people hanging off C-17s, and that will play towards people that were moving towards a Biden center will then begin moving to the right when they see, numbers of people that are going to be reallocated, to our country. The fear mongers are going to, the people that are coming are bomb makers. And, you can just sort of see the ads now. And I'll leave it as that. But your guest is doing a fabulous job of painting out the picture. But Biden needs to have the only off-ramp, and I'll leave it as this, is that he needs to extend the arbitrary line in the sand that has been established and do everything we possibly can to get the folks that helped us and interpreters and all the other folks that helped us outside of Kabul and outside the boundaries with that airport.
Mark, thank you so much for that call. Mark talking about the politics, but also seemingly the moral implications as well. How do you respond to Mark?
It's not up to me to say who's right in that, but I will say there's a growing number of governors, a bipartisan set of governors, from Virginia Governor Ralph Northam to Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, Utah Governor Spencer Cox, Oregon Governor Kate Brown, who have all said that they would be willing to take a lot of those refugees. As a matter of fact, Governor Tony Evers put out something yesterday saying that that refugees who had helped U.S. forces were welcome in Wisconsin. And I think that's going to become a major issue here. There is bipartisan support in Congress for bringing those interpreters, those helpers, those people who have put their lives on the line for the last 20 years to the United States to protect them. And that's one of those credibility issues. And we've heard a lot lately about America's credibility abroad. Staying in a country for 20 years is one measure of credibility, but helping those who put their lives on the line for U.S. forces is another measure of credibility. And I think that's the one that's open to the Biden administration and open to these bipartisan governors who are moving in that direction.
We are talking to Reed Wilson right now, national correspondent at The Hill. He's with us for our weekly look at the top political stories in Washington. And we want to hear from you. We are about to talk about the census. How has the population changed where you live? Have you noticed more people moving in or moving away? Do you want to see the legislature and Governor Evers compromise on new political maps for Wisconsin? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we will continue this conversation and take your calls on the census coming up in just a minute right here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we are picking up our look at the top stories in national politics. Reed Wilson stays with us from The Hill. We're switching gears a little bit to look at the census, and we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a nonpartisan approach to redistricting? What do you think a fair redistricting process looks like? And what questions do you have for our guest about what we saw come out of the census? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now, Reed, we are talking about the census now. What did we learn from this recent set of data from the U.S. Census Bureau?
I got to say, it's a pretty hard shift here from Census Bureau stuff from Afghanistan to the Census Bureau. But it's absolutely fascinating. What we saw is an American population that grew more slowly over the last decade than we've seen in basically any decade since the 1930s in the wake of the Great Depression, and a population that's diversifying more quickly than we've ever seen in American history. We're getting vaguely a little bit older, but we're getting remarkably more diverse in every state in the entire country. At the same time, we're also getting more urban and less rural as a nation. Now, that's a trend that shouldn't surprise anybody. That's been happening basically since the beginning of the Republic. And we are seeing a population that is slowly moving south and west. Again, trends that we've seen for basically since the first census in 1790.
And can you talk a little bit about, I know that there has been this talk for a long time that 2040 was going to be the year that the number of, you know, white Americans dropped below the number of non-white Americans. But it looks like we're seeing that happen a little bit faster. Can you talk about some of the circumstances that led to that shift in that demographic specifically?
Sure. The big trend that you're talking about there and the big headline that came out of last week's numbers were that the number of white Americans who live in the United States on April 1st, 2020 was lower than the number of white Americans who live in the United States on April 1st, 2010, a decade ago. That's the first time that the number of non-Hispanic whites has dropped over the course of a decade. And it's for a couple of different reasons. One of the things that has constantly struck me as I've been watching census numbers over the last decade is just how long the fallout has been from the Great Recession that we experienced back in 2007, 8, 9, well, really 8 and 9, even though it ended in 2010. The hangover has basically meant that people have had fewer children over the long run. They have had children later in life, which contributes to that fewer children number. And the people have had less economic opportunity, which is associated with things like having families and sort of advancing through what had been a typical American life in previous generations. Today, there are about 3 million American women of childbearing age who do not have children, who, if they had been members of previous generations, we would have expected them to have children. So that change is happening most among white Americans, and it's for a lot of different reasons. You know, people are delaying having kids for economic reasons. Maybe they don't think they can afford it. Maybe they don't have a partner. They can't find a house, which is something that a lot of people do before they have kids. They just haven't hit those markers. And all of that is the fallout from the Great Recession a decade ago. We've seen population growth slow over the course of the decade. I should stress, by the way, that all of this population decline comes before COVID, because remember, the census count happens on April 1st of 2020, and we'd only lost about 1,000 people to the coronavirus as of April 1st, 2020. So all of this was taking place long before the pandemic even came around.
We're talking to Reed Wilson right now, national correspondent at The Hill, right now about the U.S. Census and the 2020 U.S. Census data. Now, the other thing that comes out of this is the fact that this data is going to be used to redraw maps. How is this process going to get started now that states have these statistics?
Well, it's going to be as messy as possible in a lot of states, and you're seeing that in Wisconsin right now. But in a lot, so every state basically has different rules. But every state will now take this data, which is population data down to the block level, and they will use it to redraw their political boundary lines, whether that's lines for Congress, lines for state legislature. In cities that have city council districts, they'll redraw those lines too, so that everybody has basically equal population. Now, some states give the power to the legislature to draw the lines and the authority to the governor to approve or reject those maps. That's the case in Wisconsin. Other states give the power to an independent commission, or they allow the legislature to draw maps without the input of the governor. But basically, all of this, I mean, the redistricting process is an inherently partisan exercise. The two sides, regardless of who controls what in various states, will use this to try to give themselves the greatest possible advantage in the course of the next 10 years, because this is the lines under which all of our legislative bodies will be determined. Well, at least legislative bodies that have district lines will be determined over the next 10 years. So it's going to be a process that doesn't lead to a lot of people making friends. We've seen that in Wisconsin. Democrats have already sued to try to force a federal court to prepare to draw new district lines in anticipation of the state legislature, which is obviously controlled by Republicans, and the governor, who is obviously a Democrat, not getting along and not finding an answer. And based on the way, you know, the legislative Republicans and Governor Evers have interacted over the last couple of years, you know, the fact that they might not, or the prospect of them not coming to an agreement is, you know, a reasonable conclusion to draw.
Reed, I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Rose in Menominee Falls. Hi, Rose.
Hi there. I was just at a meeting last night, actually, at a local municipal city council where they were we were requesting that the city council support a Fair Maps resolution. And, of course, there have been proposals made, and the governor has already appointed a Fair Maps commission. And for the life of me, you just said a few minutes ago that the current process is inherently partisan. We all know that. We've all suffered with that. It doesn't matter if it's the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. What our request is that you take it out of the hands of that whole political game, and at least there's more of a chance for Fair Maps that would be representative for all people.
Rose, thank you so much for that call. In Wisconsin, we have had this issue about a Fair Maps commission and whether or not it's going to actually come to fruition. Is there a sort of groundswell for more of these nonpartisan redistricting to kind of level the playing field on a national level?
Well, there has been progress towards more states adopting these independent commissions. But I'll say that at least in a couple of states where they have cropped up, Missouri, Michigan, Virginia, even those independent commissions have been bogged down by partisan arguments. In Missouri, it's so bad that they couldn't agree on a chair of the committee. In Virginia, just yesterday, they met, this bipartisan committee met, and they weren't even able to agree on members of a subcommittee that would deal with various different sets of maps. So the question of fair, if you ask 10 politicians what is a fair map, you're going to get 10 or 12 different answers. So the notion of fair is sort of hard to come by. Who is to say what is fair? Is it a map that guarantees Democrats and Republicans representation in a legislative body? Is it a map that makes every district competitive? I mean, those are two things that can be tension points, sort of with each other. So there is no agreement on what fair actually means in drawing a map. And that's something that, I mean, you'll hear both Democrats and Republicans saying, we want fair maps. But of course, you drill down there and you ask what's fair, and they have very different answers.
Reed, we'll have to leave it there. Wish we had more time, but thank you so much for joining us today. That was Reed Wilson. He's the national correspondent at The Hill, and he joined us for our weekly wrap-up of the top news in national politics.